You ever get the feeling that everything in America is completely f***ed up?
They're saying I should think stuff. Something is wrong with me.
To be so cynical.
Practice.
Welcome to Positive Cynicism. We are kicking off our next 100 episodes. We made it to episode 101. Just a reminder, check out all the other good shows here on the Jittery Monkey Podcasting Network, Nerd United, My 123 Cents, which if you go back and listen to episode, I believe it's 243. I think that's the episode. Yours truly is a guest on that show, so thanks to Kevin Hunsberger, who was the guest on the 100th episode of Positive Cynicism. And there's also the Five Heart Podcast, which is hosted by Greg Mahochko, who also does Nerd United. And go check those out. Go to jitterymonkey.com, buy some merchandise, help support struggling podcasters so that we don't have to resort to begging you on Patreon. And more importantly, we don't have to come up with prizes or gifts for Patreon subscribers and tier levels. So buy a shirt. Help us out. That's all I'm going to say for this beginning. We're going to go into commercial break. And then on the flip side, we're going to talk movies of 1999.
Hi, this is Greg Mahochko, the host of Nerds United on the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. And over the years that I've been running the Nerds United show, I've been fortunate enough to speak with many of my talented friends, both artists and writers, creators of comic books, but I've also spoken with some more recognizable names in comics and entertainment. Legendary artist Greg Land, hey, we Greg's gotta stick together. Writer Colin Bunn, Rock and Roll Hall of Famer, and comic book creator DMC Daryl McDaniels, The Flash of yesteryear, and in more recent memory, Flash's dad, John Wesley Shipp, and a lot more. And I encourage you to subscribe to the Nerds United podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, or you can check it out anytime you want on jitterymonkey.com. And as founder of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network, I really do appreciate your support. When you share a podcast, you help get our little corner of the podcasting world out to even more people. So anytime you do that, you really don't know how much we appreciate it. So share away.
Years ago, a battle was fought. And an empire was destroyed. Now, the saga will continue.
You were expecting someone else?
Yeah! Oh yeah, baby!
If you see only one movie this summer, see Star Wars. But if you see two movies, see Austin Powers.
That's right, Mr. Bigglesworth. We're back.
Oh, behave.
The Spy Who Shagged Me.
Hello, help me with the chair, please. All I wanted was a frickin' rotating chair.
Throw me a bone here, people.
That was probably one of the most clever trailers, teasers to come out of, well, obviously 1999 or... maybe that was late 98, but on this episode, as we've been doing all month here on Positive Cynicism, we're talking about 1999, and this episode, we're looking at specifically at the cinema of 1999. So once again, I have brought on the cinema expert, the fan expert, Eric Bennett. Welcome to the show, Eric.
Thanks for having me. Can't wait to talk about the end of the 90s.
Yeah, and, you know, in some regard, probably the end of, I don't want to say the golden era of cinema, but this was a year before a lot of repetition and a lot of remakes and sequels and prequels. And although when we look at the top two of the top five films, they're sequels and prequels. But
yeah, it was definitely starting that trend, or definitely producing the trend that they came after.
Yeah. Now, do you I guess our first question is always, do you remember what you were doing in 1999, or is there any specific memory of 1999 that sticks out to you?
Well, I have a birthday which is easy to kind of go back on because I was born in 70, so I'd have been 29. So I was in Seattle planning to move to California at 30. Mm-hmm. So that whole year was about me trying to quit my job and save up money and move my entire life to Los Angeles in search of fame and fortune. So that was, I remember The Matrix being everything, which I know we'll talk about. Mm-hmm. Your favorite movie.
Yes, one of my favorite.
Favorite overrated movies.
Yes, you can go back to our overrated episode and get my thoughts on The Matrix. I'm sure we'll touch more on it here soon. But yeah, do you remember? Okay, well, let's start with the big part of 1999. Because I know for you and I, something we had been waiting for 15 years,
mm-hmm.
finally came out. We finally got to see the prequel to the movies that probably started our movie fandom. And that was the return of Star Wars to the Megaplex.
Yes, it looked like Star Wars. It felt like Star Wars, but looking back at it, it wasn't a good Star Wars movie. Where were you when you saw it?
I went with friends to a midnight screening. And I have a soft spot in my heart for Phantom Menace just because at this midnight screening, sitting there, we're all jazzed up because obviously all my friends, huge Star Wars fans.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're like, I think the high of being in there, it didn't matter what the movie was. It was going to be good when we walked out.
Now, yeah.
You know, when you reflect, when you let it soak in, you may have a different opinion. But we were going to be like, this is the greatest moment ever. And we're sitting there, we're watching it, and it gets up to the pod race scene. And Qui-Gon picks up Anakin, puts him in the pod race, and the power goes out.
I think you told me that.
And, yeah, so we sat there for about 10 minutes.
That's like one of the two good scenes in that movie.
Yeah. And it was just, we sat there for about 10 minutes, and then all of a sudden the employees came in and said, there's a power outage. We don't know when it's going to come back on. Oh. We'll give you a free ticket. You can come back and watch it some other time. So,
wow.
And because I was working, my friends were in college or had stuck around after college to watch this movie. So they went back because it was a Thursday night screening.
That's right.
Yeah, they went back Friday morning at like 8 or 9 o'clock to watch it. And I was stuck at work, so I didn't get to see it until later that evening.
Now, how was the second time?
It was still good because it's still Star Wars, and you're still hyped up for it because you hadn't seen the whole thing.
Yeah.
And you want to see Darth Maul. But yeah, it. Looking back now with kind of a cynical take and seeing the whole trilogy as a whole, it was not what we expected. And part of it, you know, has been debated about by countless other podcasts and blogs and websites and whatnot. The whole plot, the whole political aspect of the storytelling is not for kids. And that's George Lucas's defense of the film is, oh, these were always kids' movies. And the people that were seeing it now who had seen the original were too old or it's different. Which I do think there is some validity in that argument.
Yeah.
But kids don't want to hear about trade federations and, you know, that type of stuff. So
blockades and...
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think I'll get into a lengthy review, but I was in Seattle, same thing, midnight show, mm-hmm. and I agree with you. Like, there's no way I wasn't going to like it coming out of it, but something was off, and I knew it, but then when we talked about it after the movie, we're like, oh, that's great, we'll see it again, and then when I saw it the second time, I was like, there's something missing from the movie, and then after it sat for a while, I started getting disappointed, but that's when your expectations are obviously set to the old ones. Mm-hmm. And like you said, the political stuff and Jar Jar Binks and really that kid, and I don't want to pick on him, I've said this before, but that kid is just so bad in that movie.
Yeah.
And the acting's wooden and the two leads weren't... That movie's, to me, it's kind of a mess. And it's Lucas's worst impulses. It's like I'm a technocrat, I have all this money, I founded a tech company that makes effects, and then I'm have everything blue screened in the movie. And it didn't feel like a lot of it was very practical. And then all the good characters were, that should have lasted to the second and third movie, were killed off, Qui-Gon and Darth Maul. And it's like, really, you got rid of your Vader, and you got rid of, like, well, I know they got rid of Obi-Wan pretty quick in the other one, too, but, yeah, I mean, without getting a lengthy review, it was a lot of disappointment, but that sat in months, probably after I saw it. So, it still was exciting, you know, and I think you would probably agree, I wouldn't take back going to it and being as excited as I was, because there was so much positivity among the fans. And it's interesting. I was just came back from Chicago Star Wars Celebration, and that movie is being looked upon very fondly now with the fan base, because those kids have grown up since 99. So that movie, I never would say it's holding up, but people are kind of like thinking more positively about that movie than they did when they were our age watching it.
And I think that generation who saw Phantom Menace as their first introduction to Star Wars, or at least the first movies in the theater, probably view it much more favorably than the original, because I think Jar Jar would play better to a younger audience.
Yeah.
I think, you know, and I think the one of the biggest problems both with Phantom Menace and Attack of the Clones, when we see young Boba Fett, is I think the characters were ruined by being too young.
Yeah.
I don't need to see that childhood. And for me, I know I don't want to get this off into a whole Star Wars discussion, but for me, I think episode 3 should have been episode 2, and the first one should have been like where 2.5 would have been.
Yeah.
And I also, looking back, I will always say that Darth Vader never should have showed up in the original trilogy.
Oh, yeah, you're not a big fan of them backstoring everything in Star Wars.
No, I just think if not showing Darth Vader would have helped keep the reveal in episode 5.
Yeah, you know, you mentioned that. I think that's interesting. What I do like, as flawed as those old ones are, not to contradict you too much, is that it gives a more sympathetic version of Vader, which I'm not sure that's what we really want, because he's such a good villain. He gets sympathetic at Return of the Jedi.
Yeah.
So that's very effective. But, you know, seeing, you know, what happened to his mother, and seeing the rift between him and Obi-Wan and how violent that was, that I thought that was actually pretty cool. It wasn't shot very well. It wasn't directed great, but it adds a little bit more when you see the other ones and you see what he went through as a kid. Again, not executed well. So to me, those movies don't really exist too much for me anymore. Just 4, 5, 6 of the new ones, but that made a huge splash. I don't know what the box office was, but number one is what you said?
Yeah, it was number one for the year, probably. And total gross for 1999 was $431 million.
Yeah, which adjusted has got to be billions or a billion plus or something. Yeah, that was huge. So to you kiddies out there, you know, that was a big deal. We had waited a decade and a half for it, so that was a big deal in 99.
Yeah, and while we're talking Phantom Menace, let's go ahead and jump into a topic about trailers.
Mm.
Because as I said, we started the show off with the teaser for Austin Powers 2, which I think Austin Powers was a modest hit, but then found life on home video and cable, and Austin Powers 2 actually made more money than the original, and they teased that movie by appearing to be a Star Wars trailer.
Mm-hmm.
But do you remember when the Phantom Menace trailer came out? I remember it was playing in front I remember MTV going crazy and being like, we're going to premiere the new trailer and blah, blah, blah. But I remember the theatrical trailer was in front of it's a Michelle Pfeiffer movie, Michelle Pfeiffer, George Clooney film.
I'm not sure what that is.
Another Day, something. I can't remember. It was in my notes.
It was tagging on to that audience?
It was tagging on to that. And I remember calling up the theater and be like, I'm going to come see Scream, but can I go into the other theater and just watch the trailers?
Yeah.
And they go to Scream. And they're like, sure. Like, why are you calling it? Yeah. And I remember even Phantom Menace was also, another trailer was attached to Wing Commander. And a lot of people, I think, went and saw Wing Commander, saw the trailer, and then walked out.
Yeah, I do remember that back then, that people were doing that. They were just checking out the trailer and leaving just to get that rush and that look at it.
And now you look at, trailers have become like a big thing. Like, you'll go, you know, whenever a new trailer is released for a big blockbuster, it's online. You don't have to go to the theater, which, you know, also with the evolution of the internet and streaming video. But YouTube will promote a film, or or websites that cater to film base will have the link, like, here's this new trailer, and message boards, people will be talking about just what's in the trailer, and like, oh, you know, we broke down scene by scene, and did you catch this, and did you see this? And,
yeah.
And I do find it weird when trailers have teasers for the trailer before the trailer, like, the trailer starts now. It's like, good, because that's what I'm watching.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've seen teasers from Disney where they just announce the date of the teaser that's coming out. So they're teasing a tease. But yeah, I mean, I think, I wouldn't say the art of the trailer is dead. I think it's mostly negative, though, because they're showing, and I think most people would agree with this, they're showing too much at a certain point. Maybe not in the first trailer, maybe in the second trailer. So I know a lot of people are like, I'm not watching the trailers at a certain point, because they know they're just going to keep revealing too many things. So it's always good to go in cold. Like, but growing up like you, like loving, I've always loved trailers, and I'm always curious about how they put them together as an aspiring editor. So I think J.J. Abrams puts together the best teasers. Like, whether or not the movies pay off is another thing, but he gives you random, abstract, like, glimpses of things, and he tries to fool you with fake footage or reverse footage. But it's always like, I have to see this, and then I want to see the next one. And then I remember Suicide Squad had this amazing trailer. Mm-hmm. Probably the biggest gap between how bad a movie is and how good a trailer is. Man of Steel had, like, these epic trailers. So sometimes they're really effective in getting out. I think now in the, obviously we're all online just constantly, trailers can work in a negative way because it can get you to see a bad movie with a great trailer like Suicide Squad. It can blow a good movie by showing too much. Or it can just set your expectations too high so that when you see the movie, it can't live up to what you thought it was going to be in the first place. So I think the trailers are, they're too over the top, and there's too many of them right now. But occasionally you get some really good ones.
Yeah, I think trailers, one, run a little too long. I think they're about 2 minutes. They show all the good parts. Mm-hmm. And even like you were talking, I was just thinking about the Aladdin trailer, which I know there was a lot of probably hesitation from fans because remaking Aladdin live action, having Will Smith replace Robin Williams, who the genie is probably one of his best performances or mm-hmm. most loved. And that trailer, yeah, it didn't make Will Smith's character look that good. But then what I saw in the film was much better than what's in the trailer.
Yeah, you said you kind of liked it.
I mean, it's Aladdin. It's okay. But how they did the genie's performance, I felt was perfectly fine for the film.
Yeah, and that's interesting, too, because the trailer was scoffed at quite a bit. And if you look at the box office, it didn't seem to affect it. Yeah. I think it was Will Smith's, like, one of his most successful movies of all time. So, like, people turn out to Aladdin, even though people were saying the trailer looks terrible. So, Disney's got some spell. We've talked about it a million times.
Hey, I'll take it, as long as it keeps lining my pocketbook. Do you think, because I know, and we're jumping out of midnight, jumping out of 99 here for a little bit, but the Deadpool 2 trailer featured some scenes that weren't in the movie to throw off what happened to some characters.
Yeah.
In that. Do you think that, and I know there's other movies that have shot scenes specifically for the trailer, do you think that would be a better go is to for films to shoot trailer-specific footage that, you know, fits the modus of the film but isn't necessarily part of the film?
Yeah, I like that. I mean, I think that's, if it's like, not B-roll, but if it's something extra or something that puts you in the mood of the film, it's fine. I mean, again, I would just think they should just show less. I mean, there's nothing wrong with showing less. Or, again, I'll have to go back to JJ. I think he cuts the film perfectly. It's just random glimpses of things with a lot of text saying it's coming soon, you know. So I think the trailers are okay right now. They're effective in that I like going to movies, and they're getting people to go to movies, which we don't know if movie theaters will be around in 10 years. So whatever they can do, because I like going to movies, is fine with me. I think the trailers do a pretty good job of getting people interested. So,
well, another factor playing into the Star Wars Phantom Menace aspect is looking at the top 10 list of 99, Star Wars being number one, Austin Powers, as we mentioned already, is number four, and Toy Story 2 was number three.
Oh, okay.
Now, and I'm going to pull up something real quick because my notes have gotten lost, but...
Well, I know what Toy's... Well, I'll make a quick note on... Mm-hmm. I didn't care for Austin Powers at all. That was a huge drop-off for me.
See, I never saw the first one because it didn't look like... shockingly, it's not my cup of tea, not my sense of humor.
Oh, how dare you.
But so I can't speak to Austin Powers 2. But now, just looking up the top 10 films of 2019 so far, mm-hmm. as we're halfway through the year, number 9, you have Secret Life of Pets 2. Number 8 is How to Train Your Dragon 3.
Okay.
Number 7 is John Wick 3. number 5 is Spider-Man 2 or...
Or 18, depending on how many you're counting. Yeah,
counting. Number 3 is Toy Story 4. And number 1 is Avengers Endgame. And then you also have Captain Marvel, which, you know, that's one where it's like, it's not a sequel, but it plays into the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, it's a franchise slot. You know, it fits into, you know, the whole Endgame phase.
Yeah. So, looking back 20 years ago, 3 films were from sequels or... and there's a couple of remakes in here or films that were based off previous material. But now you're looking at, you know, your top 10 films every year are basically all sequels or prequels or some type of franchise piece.
Yeah, and we're on the heels of what? The Lion King coming out in mm-hmm. a week, which is probably going to be $1.5 billion.
Yeah.
And my favorite movie was Godzilla, which is another sequel of the year. And, of course, I'm looking forward to Skywalker, which is 9. You know?
Yeah.
Not counting all the standalones. So, and I actually like John Wick 3.
And don't forget Angry Birds 2 coming out in August.
Okay, I'll set my calendar on that. No, it's interesting because I was never, I think we may have touched on this very lightly before, but I was never that guy that said that I didn't like sequels because, you know, and we both grew up when, like, we wanted more Star Wars, so we got an Empire. Mm-hmm. And then, we wanted a Jedi after that. So I was always... And I know I mentioned this, but as a comic collector, I was always used to serialized story stuff. So I think people complain about it, but then we talked about this as well. I won't repeat it too many times, but Game of Thrones, like there's 60, 70 of them. So are people really getting burned out watching something over and over again? I don't think so. So I think it does speak to a larger problem, and I think you'd have to aim it a little bit at Disney, which with other live-action remakes is that They aren't coming up with anything new. So it'd be one thing if you launch a brand new thing. John Wick was like a brand new thing, so I don't mind it going a couple sequels. But if it's something that we've already seen before, that you're just dredging back up, or you're on your 6th or 7th installment, you can kind of make the argument that why don't you just start a new franchise? Because I think we all kind of like watching a new thing grow because it grows in all these sequels, but. Going back to the old ideas or just taking something that was out 10 years ago and just doing another one, if that's all you're doing, it does kind of get on people's nerves. But I'm actually never been that... I just kind of ignore a lot of those. So, like, the new It, I think, is... I'm not sure when that one's coming out. It Chapter 2.
September or October.
Yeah, I mean, that thing will do a bazillion. But I saw the first one, I was like, eh. And that's a remake of, the 80s TV television show, movies or whatever it was. So I'm used to it. I mean, we've been going through decades of this at this point. But I don't think it's the end of the universe either. So I seek out original stuff, but I also watch serialized entertainment. So I can go either way. It doesn't bother me that much.
Okay, yeah, I think if you go, you know, you look at the Star Wars where, yes, Episode 9 is coming out. But that's 3 different trilogies. And I think there's also a point in sequels where if you're telling a story, like the Star Wars films are 3 story arcs.
Mm-hmm.
Well, with the exception of the... newest trilogy where I don't know what they were thinking when they laid out that storyline.
Yeah.
But go back and listen to the Last Jedi episode. You'll get my thoughts on that. But yes, if you're telling, and I think John Wick, from what I've heard people talking about, is kind of the same thing where it's just a continuation of a story. Whereas, like, I had a problem with Deadpool 2 being just a rehash of Deadpool 1. Like,
a lot of the same jokes. That movie.
And yeah, I know we talk about a lot about sequels now. I'm like, oh, you know, everything's a sequel. But we grew up in the 80s. You know, we had, 7 Police Academies, 10 Friday the 13th, 7 Nightmare on Elm Street, 5 Halloween. Like, sequels have always been around. I think part of the problem now is sequels are promoted as being must-see, whereas before they were kind of low-budget, kind of, you know. Not
cash grabs.
Yeah, not direct-to-video, but they weren't the main films that people were going to see. Whereas, you know, looking back at Austin Powers 2, that made more money than the original.
And people, I think Hollywood started looking and saying, like, oh, if we get something that gets a bit of name brand recognition, then we can make a sequel on it and just play off that name brand.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And I think there is one danger, and I don't know if you want to talk about The Matrix now, which is okay. Probably my, I haven't seen the whole list, but probably my favorite movie of 99 and one of those movies that I think every 10 years that you just have to see. But the problem with doing sequels, and even if they're done in earnest and they're with big budgets and they're not just cash grabs in the sense of being cheap just to make money, is you do The Matrix 2 and you do The Matrix 3, and what it does is it unfortunately undoes some of the luster of the first one. So if the sequels that come are not very good, and this is, I think, what affected the Star Wars, the Phantom Menace, and all those ones too, is that you can go back, but you're taking a little bit of a chance. Because, like you say, you're taking a little bit of shine off of Vader. You're taking a little bit of shine off the franchise. So there can be a backfiring where these movies are commercially successful, but then people can be indifferent or be disappointed, and then it kind of takes the shine off the original. So I think Raiders of the Lost Ark did a pretty good job with Temple of Doom. I actually really enjoyed that movie, and then I think most people like the third one. Not my favorite, but you got to be careful even when you're doing these, and I think Toy Story's done pretty good as well, keeping up a good quality level, that you don't have a quality drop off or like the actors don't seem that interested in the movie. Because I remember watching Deadpool 2 going, I don't know if I want to watch the first one now again. Like, I was just kind of sick of it at that point, like almost instantly. So they can backfire if the quality's not there.
Yeah, it's
Jurassic Park being a good example.
Yeah, I couldn't even watch the last Jurassic World movie. And I think there is something with, you know, going back to the storytelling aspect, it's, if you have a good story versus if you are doing a cash grab, if you're just like, okay, what is the point of doing this? What are you adding to the story by doing the sequel? And a lot of times it's, well, we want to make money. You know, going back to, I believe it was 99 as well, Godzilla. Did that come out in 99? I don't want to go through the list.
I think that's a 90s movie.
98 or 99, maybe 98. But I know that made like $300 million. And Amy Pascal, who was the head of Sony at the time, said that there would be a sequel to it. Because when a movie makes $300 million, you make a sequel. And that's kind of the attitude that people have now. Is as long as we made money, then let's keep just pushing it out there. When it's like, okay, what story are you telling, though? Do you have a story, or are you... I call it the Home Alone effect, because I thought Home Alone 2 just rehashed a lot of Home Alone.
Yeah.
Same way Deadpool 2, as we mentioned. But yeah, if you're just rehashing and putting out the same product, that devalues, like you were saying, your original, and it also devalues the other sequels that may come after it, which, you know, maybe they're good because maybe you actually come up with something, but if I've already been burned once, why am I going to keep coming back?
Yeah, I mean, I think Marvel has kind of mastered the art of keeping the sequels pretty good quality. But I think the term fan service needs to be introduced, because are they making these movies? I know, of course, they're always making it for money to cover the budget and then some, but are they making these movies to only cater to the people that they think are fans of this thing? Are they actually making the movie with the intent of making something interesting? And I can't really use the word original for a sequel, but what if... And I think with Phantom Menace, like, George Lucas actually made that sincerely. He actually came up with something that I wasn't expecting. It wasn't like he was remaking Star Wars the way J.J. remade Star Wars for The Force Awakens. So Phantom Menace has some original kind of wacky, weird, like, where is this coming from stuff. But you got to be careful in that you're not making a movie just to cater. I think this is what affected Austin Powers 2 in the 90s. Was you're just making a movie because you realize the last one's popular. You try to accentuate what you thought people were... Maybe you focus tested. You said, what did people find funny about the first one? Let's just make a movie centered around that. So that's the danger, is that it may be a one-shot idea, and you can't really... This is what I think affected Deadpool as well. Like, Deadpool was a great, I think, standalone movie, and I don't think it needed a sequel. But nowadays, every studio is ordering a sequel, just like TV shows are being ordered. As long as they can make money. And I think that's the reality. And until the audience reject it, it's just going to be a thing.
Yeah. And I mean, other films that came out in the past year obviously were sequel. Even if they were a first film, like, they're leave everything open for a sequel. Thinking of like The Darkest Minds, which would have
expecting, because I believe that is also based on a series of books, but the audience didn't go and see it, so there probably will not be a sequel. All the X-Men movies, like Dark Phoenix, was left open potentially for more. And I can understand where the studios are coming from, because yes, if you can get something that's going to make money, then keep going for it. But at the same time, if that's all you're doing, and I think that's my biggest complaint, yeah, is where is the originality? Which will segue into the next comment or section. Well, I want to stick with the Matrix real quick, since you already did bring it up. But you look, and I think we're going to tie everything here kind of back to Star Wars. It's going to be our theme throughout this episode.
I love it.
You had mentioned earlier, Phantom Menace was a lot of green screen, a lot of wooden acting.
Yeah.
The Matrix also had a lot of green screen and a lot of visual effects.
Yeah.
But it was used to accent the story and tell the story and revitalized or created a lot of new visual techniques that have been spoofed, you know, in many films.
Yeah, I mean, I think The Matrix broke a lot of ground. I mean, they didn't have a gigantic budget. I think those guys had done a movie called Bound, which I still haven't seen. But they kind of came out of nowhere, and I think they wanted Will Smith for it, and then they said he was pitched to him. He's like, what are you talking about? I think we talked about that. I think, obviously, with the bullet time and the fact that they put all these Kodak cameras and they had them all exposed at the right time with the action was incredible. I think it was pretty gratuitous, but it was, it accentuated a lot of stuff, and it also brought all the wire work that was being done overseas. And I think Yen Wo Ping, the master choreographer from Hong Kong, he had done all the choreography. So there's also martial arts, which I'm a big fan of. So I don't think that gets enough credit when you talk about The Matrix, is all the kung fu that's in there and gun fu and all that stuff. And then there's this big philosophical underpinning about whether or not we're kind of sleepwalking through life, or if we're in a simulation, or if we could pick the red pill and actually do something that we want to do instead of going to an office job, which I could relate to at the time, being in an office job that I wasn't really enjoying. So I can go on about The Matrix, or that's a whole show, but I love a lot of things about that movie. In fact, like I said, the office stuff is amazing to me, but that was, and where we were talking about, you know, this obviously wasn't a sequel. That's what we need more of, is like studios taking a mid-level chance, like, I don't know, like a $50 to $80 million on something from a unique filmmaker. Like, I like, one thing I would kind of compare it to is the guy that did Ex Machina, and then he did Annihilation, which is one of my favorite movies of the year. Last year? Yeah, it was last year. So why don't we take chances on these sci-fi and fantasy stuff that's kind of original? But sometimes when you do that, the budgets get big, and then it kind of backfires as well. But yeah, The Matrix, I think, was just really fresh. It was just different. And like you said, pioneered new technology.
And obviously this is, you know, with time comes better technology, better, you know, you can speed up effects. I know there's a scene in Fight Club, which is camera goes into a trash can and you see something. But that took like 8 hours to render as the effect. And like, okay, you get one shot at this.
Yeah.
To do it. Now, in 2019, you go to a movie, everything is CGI, especially in all your superhero movies, everything, or, you know, even with Fast and Furious coming out, I believe a lot of that is CGI. I don't know exactly how much, but everything seems to culminate in a giant CGI climax battle scene. Do you think that because, to quote Jeff Goldblum from Jurassic Park, you know, directors asked whether they can't, whether they could, but not whether if they should.
Yeah, well, yeah, absolutely not. They should not be making entire movies into cartoons. And I've also made the argument that it's also expensive. It's one of those things where, like, well, we can't get so many shots practically. I mean, a famous example would be this wonderful movie, The Dark Knight, not in the 90s, but I think, was Batman Begins in 99?
No, we're more 99. Like 2004, 2005, I think.
Oh, so I'm way off.
Because I think Batman and Robin was around 98.
Oh, ouch. Yeah, I'm going to steer clear of that one. But I remember Christopher Nolan was resisting CGI, and I think the only CGI shot might have been the helicopter that crashed against the wires in Dark Knight, and everything else was like a real motorcycle or a, you know, they really flipped a truck with explosives. And no, they need to stop doing the CGI in movies. It ruined The Phantom Menace, despite the dopey script and characters. It was terrible. And The Matrix used it perfectly. They used it to accentuate certain moments, or use computers to... I know a lot of the back... When they're rotating around, they're using a lot of computers to control the backgrounds. That's the way you use it. You accentuate practical effects being in the foreground, CGI to enhance it in the background, but making it like in the foreground where the whole effect, except maybe the actor's face, is in there. No, I don't like it at all. And this is not a good trend. And it's making me check out of movies that I'm seeing now. Even Endgame, as much as I love it, there's certain sections that are just complete cartoons. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the actors are even there. So it's a problem.
That's how I feel about Attack of the Clones, which I think is the worst of the Star Wars prequels, because it just looks like a PlayStation 1 video game.
Yeah.
So, and I think Robert Zemeckis probably is one of the best directors at using CGI work subtly to enhance the film and the story.
Except for he did that Christmas movie, right, that everyone freaks out about.
Polar Express?
Yeah.
Yeah, there was
where
a time...
Things were kind of creepy and weird.
Yeah, where he went through his whole mocap phase with that. I think he did Beowulf.
But now I'm going to contradict myself. I actually like Beowulf because it was like a violent cartoon. That was kind of unique.
Yeah. I've never seen it, but it's just that where he was like, okay, everything's going to be mocap. Yeah. So it's like, and the Christmas Carol with Jim Carrey.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, and I know we're getting more and more away from the 90s, but something like Harry Potter has some practical stuff inside the academy. And then when they go outside, they're CGIing on broomsticks, or they're on a broomstick with a backdrop, and that's okay. Just mix it up a little bit. Mm-hmm. But Fast and Furious, Jurassic Park, and I made this argument with Jurassic Park, is that there's nothing in the new Jurassic Park movies that approaches anywhere near the practicality of the first one, the effects. So the Jurassic Park is still considered the holy grail of special effects, as far as I'm concerned, in modern-ish movies. And that was, what, 94? I mean, and they're making Jurassic Park movies in 2019 that don't look as good as that. So what does that tell you? You're spending three times the money. The results aren't there. So build a freaking dinosaur like, you know, Winston and whoever did it and rig it. And I think it's just laziness is what it is. It's like we can just hand it over to this division. They can just make it up.
Yeah.
And we'll just tell the actors where to look. No.
Yeah,
build something.
The same way, you know, here in a few weeks or months, the new Terminator movie is coming out.
Ugh.
And I don't know if you've seen the trailer, but a lot of the effects are basically the same thing that we saw in Terminator 2 in 1991.
Yeah, Liquid Terminator.
Yeah.
Except it can, I don't know if it's replicating into another one or a more, I mean, I think it's replicating into different types of weapons instead of just being a liquid object.
But still, it's...
Who cares? I'm not going to see it. Well, I might rent it.
Well, total sidetrack. Tim Miller is the director, and I don't know if you saw his comments regarding Comic-Con. And
no, what did he say?
He's basically saying that if you don't like this new Terminator, it's because you're a misogynist and you can't stand strong women.
Okay.
Coming from a series that features a strong woman as the protagonist and that people love.
Yeah, actually, the only part of the trailer I liked is that... Linda Hamilton's in it. That's the even when Schwarzenegger comes out, I'm like, he looks like he's 2,000 years old.
Yeah,
I like. She was the best part of that trailer, and then all of a sudden it went to a cartoon fest, and it was terrible.
So, anyway, that's a whole nother. I'm sure we'll get into that later on after Terminator comes out.
Yeah, we'll go back to the 90s.
But yes,
we're desperately running away from the 90s here, but we're trying to stay on track.
CGI is becoming too much, too prolific, and like you said, they need to focus more on story because now it becomes a spectacle, which at the same time I understand because you have home theater systems. You know, everyone has HD TVs and surround sound. So what is going to get people into a theater? Are you going to go watch, you know, recently the movie Booksmart came out, which is supposed to be really good. I did not see it, but it's just a simple story about two girls.
I want to see it.
It looks good.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to see it, but especially with ticket prices being what they are, and especially here in L.A., are you going to spend $16, $20 to go see something like that, or are you going to go spend that on in-game to see the spectacle of something that needs to be seen in the biggest screen possible?
I mean, that's a good question. I think with in-game, for me, that would be I just had to see it because I love so many of the other movies. Mm-hmm. I mean, collecting comic books since I was a kid, so So that aside, I won't just go to a spec. I really do not go to spectacle movies anymore for a spectacle. I don't know if a lot of people are, and I think the studios need to start figuring that out, because one big problem with CGI is that, to me, it's hit a point where it's not looking that much better. So, like, CGI from 3-4 years ago in a Marvel movie doesn't look that much better in Endgame. They're putting maybe more characters on screen, but I'm not really believing it anymore. And I think the problem with CGI is it violates the biggest, like, tenet of movie making, which is that it has to be believable. So you go to a movie, and for some reason you feel like you're either in the story or you believe what's going on screen. If you don't believe it or buy into it, then you don't connect to it at all. You're just tuned out. So when I'm watching a movie and then it turns into a cartoon, I'm like, hey, when is this going to be over? And then it goes back, and if there's practical effects, I can stay in that mode longer. So I think that them pulling the wool over eyes that many times is having an effect. It's not having an effect in the box office, because a lot of young people in the Chinese market is drawing the box office. But I actually see these things burning out after a certain period of time. I think CGI will hit a point where it doesn't look much better. And then people, with the advent of all the services at home, may start rejecting some of the spectacles. And you're already seeing a couple of them flop here and there if they're not well made. I'm not even hearing good things about Lion King. I know it'll make a lot of money. But I like to see some of these movies get rejected if they're not good movies, based on the fact that it's just empty spectacle.
Mm-hmm. And it seems the box office this year is down, and a lot of sequels are not doing as well as expected, which I don't know if that's sequel fatigue or if they're just sequels that no one wanted to begin with.
Yeah.
But I think, to your point, a lot of people went and saw Avengers Endgame this year because
a whole lot.
It was, you know, it was going to be the water cooler talk. Everyone's going to see it. You want to see it before it's spoiled. Well, back in 1999, there were two movies that came out that had that same type of hype and that shared needing to say that. One of them was a very low-budget film. And I know a lot of people, you can see that Star Wars Episode One is probably like the most highest-based independent film, because George Lucas financed it himself.
That's funny. I never thought about that.
But it, coming in at number 10 for the year, is a low-budget, kind of self-financed film that got traction through the internet, through a viral campaign, before the movie even started filming.
Oh, I know what it is.
It's a little film called The Blair Witch Project.
I love it. I just read a huge article about it. I believe it was on Rotten Tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Oh, I love that movie, and I'm not going to apologize. Yeah. I love everything about that movie. I know people like to... Well, I want to get your take on the movie. I know maybe we're not doing a review show here, but I love that movie. I love the concept. I love what it did budget-wise. And talk about a perfect example of how an idea trumps spectacle. You know, this was a movie with a brilliant marketing campaign that people thought was real. Mm-hmm. And for what few people are listening that have not seen this movie, I don't think, you know, it's been out for a while, so hopefully we can spoil some of it. But you need to go watch this movie. It's excellent filmmaking on a dime, basically.
Yeah.
$20,000.
It's an interesting film. I actually prefer Blair Witch 2 to Blair Witch 1.
Oh, I don't know if I've seen that.
But you can't deny, again, this movie seeped into our conscience to where people were talking about. I remember I was working on a film in the summer of 99, and the actors had a bootleg copy of the film. And it was just like this thing, like, oh, you have to see this. You have to go and see it. And again, they did it well by having a good marketing campaign, a trailer that really didn't show you anything, because the film really doesn't show you anything either. There's no special effect. You know, it's a good psychological film that it didn't scare me watching it, but on the drive home when I was thinking about it and playing it in my head, that's where it affected me.
Yeah, well, I scare pretty easily. I can't even watch a lot of horror films, but that movie scared me. Because I think it plays into this thing of, like, you're lost in the woods. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's bad things after you, so that's never fun. But the whole idea of, like, and that pioneered the whole found footage movement, which, for anyone that's seen a movie with excessive handheld shots, that came from the Blair Witch Project. I'm sure you could find something that was notable earlier, but that's largely considered the found footage. Mm-hmm. And that goes beyond horror, you know. So that movie was... I mean, we haven't gone through a lot of this list, but that is an extremely notable movie from this time, and everybody should watch this movie if you haven't seen it.
Yeah, and then same way, the number two movie that year of 1999 was a movie called The Sixth Sense, which, again, original idea, low budget, but got people talking and made it a communal experience to where you wanted to see it before it got spoiled.
Oh, absolutely. I don't remember if I saw it in the movie theater or not. That's the only, I think I did, but I can't tell you where. And that was another movie that just, I can never see anything coming. I never saw the ending coming. And that's an all-time, I don't know what the budget was on that movie. That's why everyone likes M. Night, because his movies basically cost nothing and they make a ton of money. But that's the same thing we're talking about. There's little to no CGI in it. And again, we were talking about CGI earlier. I don't think 99 CGI was all the way there yet, but they were able to realize most of what the directors wanted, for better or for worse. But the movies we're talking about now, Blair Witch and Sixth Sense, there's hardly anything, hardly any CGI. It's all concept. And, you know, you have to have a good actor like Bruce Willis, and I'll just point to that kid in that movie as being astounding, because most kid actors don't do it for me. But that kid actor was just awesome. What was it?
Haley Joel Osment.
Yeah, I always forget how to say his name. Or remember his name. But yeah, I love that movie. That was fantastic. So now 99 is really shaping up pretty good.
Yeah, and I'll just... So we've mentioned most of the top 10. I'll just throw out the other four that we haven't yet. You had two movies. You had Disney's Tarzan, which... It's a Disney film. Most Disney films.
Oh, the animated one?
Yeah.
I like that one. I have that. I own that one. I thought it was good.
And then that came at number six. Number eight was The Mummy with Brendan Fraser, which... It was a fun film. And unfortunately, I think that's where Universal has tried to remake it, you know, in the last year with Tom Cruise. And they just... I think it's part of their plan to do this dark universe with all their monster films.
Yeah.
Where they missed what made this Mummy in 1999 what people wanted to see.
Yeah.
And I think the new one was a little too serious.
The other one, Brendan Fraser has like a bullwhip and a fedora.
Yeah.
And
yeah, it's kind of like him doing Indiana Jones.
Oh, boy.
Pass. And then the other two movies, number nine was Runaway Bride, which paired up Julia Roberts and Richard Gere for the first time since Pretty Woman.
Oh, I don't think I saw that.
So, and this was, Julia Roberts was still a bankable actress.
Oh yeah, big time.
And then number seven is Big Daddy, when Adam Sandler was very much a bankable actor.
Yeah, now we're sinking in the depths there for me.
And so actually, I just had this thought when I said that is, those two were sold basically on the premise of the actor. And yeah. That's another thing that we don't have as much today as we used to, which is, you know, you can say Will Smith is in this film, or, well, I'll say, does anybody care if Chris Pratt or Jennifer Lawrence or, you know, maybe Robert Downey Jr., but or Chris Hemsworth, if you say these guys are in films, or these actors, is anybody going to go see them, or do they see their movies that they saw because they were franchise pieces?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, Hollywood has always existed on the star system. But I think what we're having now is that there isn't a real bankable star system right now. I mean, Tom Cruise had a lot of success with the new Mission Impossible, but all these stars seem to be aging out. And I really can't think of a whole batch of like stars that are coming up that are like surefire hits. Like, where's the young Tom Cruise? You know, Brad Pitt's not getting younger. Leonardo's good, but he doesn't do like the big blockbuster films. You know, Sylvester Stallone's 90, Schwarzenegger's 2000. So who are these people? I mean, Chris Pratt isn't, and Jennifer Lawrence aren't going to bring in the box office unless it's a very known thing. Yeah. Like you said, that they just kind of tagged along with, whether it's Hunger Games or Guardians of the Galaxy. And, well, I guess Chris Pratt's pretty big with Jurassic Park as well.
But again,
but they're not seeing it because of him. Yeah. I mean, I think they're seeing it because Jurassic Park always makes $1 billion, no matter who they put in it. So I don't think that's around. And maybe in the 90s, you've named a few where it was kind of a big deal. But we don't have those stars that just automatically draw profits like we used to.
We used to, yeah. So that's where, I mean, we've just gone through and given you some idea of where film was in 1999 and where it is in 2019. I'm curious to hear your thoughts. Are there stars out there? Do you want to see more sequels? Do you want CGI films? Or what do you think Hollywood should be doing to get, you know, a bigger audience? And Eric, you touched on the Chinese market earlier. And I think right now part of the problem is, instead of making films for different quadrants of an audience. It's got to encircle the entire chart, and it's got to play well overseas, and it's got to do well.
Yeah, and I think using the word dumbed down would be insulting, but it's more mainstreamed. It's taking a mainstream movie and making it globally mainstreamed, mm-hmm. which means that it's going to be even more broad in yeah. its appeals.
So, well, that's going to wrap up this edition as we look at 1999. We'll be back next month. Eric, I know you're getting ready as this episode drops. You'll be heading back down to San Diego for Comic-Con 2019.
Oh, yeah, the Nerd Mecca.
Yeah, so I'm sure next month we'll be talking, we'll touch on that, get your thoughts on this year's lineup and everything. But we'll be back next month with another topic, so stick around. And remember to check out all the other shows here on JitteryMonkey.com. And check out the archives of Positive Cynicism if you're just now finding the show, which we are now on Spotify, which if you're listening on Spotify, you know that. So I don't know why I'm telling you that. But that's going to do it for this week. As always, question everything, do something positive.
This is a production of the Jittery Monkey Podcast Network. For more jittery shenanigans, go to jitterymonkey.com.